You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
My name is Stephanie Ann Nye. I was born September 2nd, 1952 in San Pedro, California.
Stephanie Nye is a lovely, kind, intelligent woman. She grew up mainly overseas and lived in many interesting places, including Libya, Switzerland to attend boarding school, and Vietnam during the war. And that's just to name a few. Eventually, Stephanie landed in Boise, Idaho, where she met and married her sweetheart, Brent Nye, and joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Together, they have four wonderful children who, in stark contrast to Stephanie's childhood, were all raised in their family home of nearly 50 years. Stephanie has spent her life serving and caring for others. She is patriotic, positive, and faithful.
I'm the second of four. We're all, 5 to 6 years apart. So my sister was 18. I was 12. My younger sister was 6 when my brother was born. So there's 18 years between my older sister and my younger brother. My father was a civil engineer. He got his degree from Berkeley, but he soon got a job in Morocco, in Africa, and we soon moved there. He worked for Morrison Knudsen. It was an international construction company. And many of the jobs overseas were to build power plants, things like that. They were bringing electricity to third world countries. So we lived many places. My mother was afraid to fly. She had claustrophobia. And so we lived in Naples, Italy, before we went to Libya. We stayed there for about 6 months. I think that's when I had my 7th birthday, was in Naples. So since my mother did not like to fly, we went by ship. It wasn't like going on a cruise ship by any means. We went via freighter. We drove to Houston and got on the Del Rio. That was the name of the freighter. The freighter holds 12 passengers, and they're treated like royalty. And freighters are very heavy laden with all of the cargo. So it's very slow going across the ocean. And then you stop at different ports and then they take freight off and then they put other freight on your ship. And so the whole process takes about 6 weeks at sea, but we were treated very well because all of these crew members, they've been at sea for a long time. So they were excited to have, a family. My dog Heidi was given to me as I turned seven in Naples, Italy. My dad promised me a dog. And so that's when I got my little dachshund named Heidi. And Heidi traveled the world with us. The next place I went to go live would have been Tripoli, Libya. This was before Gaddafi's rule, but it was just starting to have safety issues for the Americans. But again, paid Morrison Knudsen to come bring a power plant in. But there was a lot of unrest. Not too long after we left, Libya became very anti-American. There were times in Libya that I got a little nervous just because my dad would say, don't look him in the eye. We'd have to all be covered, even though it was hot. And he'd always make sure that we always looked down, that we didn't look people in the eye, because that just wasn't accepted. I remember one time, we always had a driver in a car, a company car, and our driver was driving us and he hit a dog. And I remember crying and telling my dad, to tell our driver to stop. And he said, I'll always remember what my dad said. No, we can't stop. We'll get stoned. Don't you understand? So I have those kinds of memories, but it was still okay to have Americans in Tripoli when we lived there. Our embassy was still there. I went to school at Wheelis Air Force Base, which was at the time one of the biggest American Air Force bases. I went to second and third grade there. And I remember going to school in a diesel yellow big bus. So it was there were enough Americans that we would go into Wheelis Air Force Base. And our maid was Zanzi. And, oh, I just loved her. She just giggled and would laugh. And I remembered I loved to help her. And we always had a lot of brass. And I remember that she'd always take a lemon and cut it in half. And that's what she would clean the brass with. We lived near the Mediterranean. And the Mediterranean Sea was absolutely beautiful, beautiful blue. The tile on the floor was blue, and it kind of looked like the reflection of the water. But we would walk down to the Mediterranean. It was the most beautiful, gorgeous sea that I've ever been to. I think it was when we left Tripoli, Libya. And we were one day out of docking in New York, and we were in a hurricane. And it was pretty rough, obviously. But the wave broke open the porthole. They had to turn the ship and head back towards Europe so that the wind was not coming in that same direction and they could fix the porthole. So once they fixed the porthole, then we could turn around and go back. And I remember the next day when we pulled up into the harbor of New York and saw the Statue of Liberty. And again, my parents taking the opportunity to have a teaching moment about patriotism and what the Statue of Liberty meant. And my mother had memorized the words on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty. And even at a young age, I knew that was pretty special, that my mom would stand there on the deck of the ship and repeat that. The next main place that we lived would have been Abidjan Ivory Coast. Now, Abidjan Ivory Coast is on the west part of Africa. So I arrived in the Ivory Coast the day after President Kennedy was shot, November 22nd, 1963. So I was 11 years old, and I remember thinking when they said, President Kennedy has been shot, how did we know? How could we possibly know? We'd been at sea for all this time. I was just stunned. And the next day, we docked into Abidjan. And my parents always taught me patriotism. They taught me to be proud to be an American. And when my parents said to remember who I was representing my country. And the day after President Kennedy was shot, we docked into Abidjan Ivory Coast. And I will always remember seeing everyone dressed in black and crying over the loss of my president. And remember, it took us like 6 weeks to get over there. So it seems like to me we were like on a different planet. You know, we were so far away from the States, in my opinion, that I couldn't even imagine how they even heard. And they even changed the name of the square in Abidjan. They called it the John F. Kennedy Square.
During this time of Stephanie's life, she attended a French private school.
Collège de Jean-Marmont. It was a private school. We wore uniforms, and it was kindergarten to 12th grade, and so I was in the fifth grade. I think they might have put me back in fourth grade thinking maybe it would help because I didn't know any French. My father taught me one sentence in French before I left to school that day, and it was, Je suis Américain. I am an American, and off to school I went. Now, this French school was 7:30 in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We had a 7-course lunch and 2-hour siesta, and it was all day. My sister, Debbie, was like in kindergarten or first grade, and my sister, older sister, was, you know, in 10th grade or whatever. And so we would stand at attention in our lines at school. Attention, fixe! Now, I've remembered this since I've been in fifth grade. And then we would sing the French national anthem, the national anthem of the Ivory Coast, and the school song. And I remember some of the words to the school song, even though it was 1963. Mermoz ton courage, mermoz ton grand cours, pour nous te restera l'exemple vivant.
Kiki Dorano Pa Mermos Donis Bas.
And it was the Jean Mermoz song, and that was my school song that I remembered because I sang it every single morning, the French National Anthem, the National Anthem of the Ivory Coast, and the Jean Mermoz song. It was a strict school. That very first day when I got to school, there was a man that had a limp. I found out later he had polio, and he had a whistle. And he came running at me, screaming, saying something to me. And I just kept saying, je suis Americain, je suis Americain. And I could figure out either from him pointing, I was walking on the grass and I was to walk on the sidewalk. So that was my first thought of that school. Remember, I only know one sentence in French. And I was always a large girl and bigger than the little French kids. And so someone came into the classroom and they all immediately stood at attention by their desks. And I was still sitting there and I kind of just slithered out of my desk and they kind of giggled at me. And so I thought, aha, I got this figured out. When someone walks in the classroom, stand up. So the next time someone came into the classroom, I stood up and I was the only one. And so they kind of laughed again at me. And I soon found out that there's certain people you stood up for. And I remember that was the only time that I cheated. Maybe it was once a week and my teacher would stand up at the front of the classroom and she would recite a paragraph. And then each child had to write that paragraph out. And I had no clue what she was saying and I had no idea what to write. So I think she felt sorry for me because she came and gave me the paragraph the night before. And so I never told my parents, but I would go home and I would write out that paragraph on a piece of paper and then I would put it inside my desk. And so then when we had dictée and I would just not know, have any idea what to write, and then I'd switch papers and I got good grade on my dictée. But there were times when I had no idea what our class did that was wrong because instead of being able to play at recess, we would have to stand, walk around the playground with our arm behind our back, walking around and around. But that was always the pits because I always had no idea what we did and I just had to walk around the playground instead of play. But the second sentence that I learned in French after Je suis Américain was Repichez votre chose. And the reason why I learned that sentence was because at the end of every day at school, my teacher would say Repichez votre chose. And I didn't know exactly what it meant, but I knew it was time to leave because everybody would be getting their backpacks or gathering their things. And come to find out, it meant gather your things. So that was a strict school. I mean, they would come around with a stick and hit kids on the back of their legs when we would stand at attention. And I learned later on that the next year, my parents decided I shouldn't go back to that school. So this next year, my parents decided that I would go into a one-room schoolhouse. So there were just not very many Americans who lived there. So there was like maybe six or seven of us. And my parents put an ad in the paper, the Wall Street Journal. I don't know how Mr. John Delaney, who just graduated from college, and his wife answered to the ad. So Mr. Delaney flew over from New Jersey to become our teacher. And so I had a little one-room schoolhouse. I was oldest by then and down to, you know, maybe first grade or something. We became good friends with the Delaneys. My mother had some health issues. There were different times in places that we lived that she would have to be medevaced out of the area. So this one time it was Christmas. My mother had to be medevaced to Paris for some surgeries. And then my sister, Kathy, who was in boarding school in Switzerland, went to Paris to be with them for Christmas. And then my younger brother was born in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. So my sister Debbie and Stephen and I all stayed with the Delaneys for Christmas, and I remember them taking care of us. But the Ivory Coast was a wonderful place. We had a lovely home on the lagoon, and we had a sailboat. And I loved going on the sailboat and just sailing by myself around the lagoon. We also had a swimming pool and we had coconut trees. And I remember that you had to be careful because when coconuts fall, they really hurt when they would fall on you. We had a driver and we had a wonderful cook and his name was Mamadou. And we used to always say, Mamadou, Mama won't, Mama will. I just remember. And he He had black skin with scars from the tribe that he was from. And he had been the chef for the French ambassador before he was our cook. He had a white uniform with big brass buttons, and he'd have a towel over his arm. And I used to love and go help him in the kitchen. You know, I remember we'd make avocados with shrimp in it for our appetizer. You know, he fixed fancy foods. There were these little snakes that would live up in the tree. They were the green and black garner snake. They're very poisonous, and they would call them like 1 or 2 foot snakes. If they bit you, you could live for 1 or 2 steps after that. So mort means die or kill in French. And so when those little snakes would fall out of our trees, I remember we had gardeners, and they'd tell us, mort, 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 you know, and tell us to run away from these little snakes. But we didn't have windows in our house. We had metal grate, but that allowed snakes to crawl in to your house. And so sometimes when you would sleep, you'd open up your door and there would be snakes in the hall. The other thing I didn't really like about that is there were worms. There were all kinds of different kinds of worms. But the two kind of worms that I remember getting was there was one that would burrow in the bottom of your foot. And so you could see like this little red line, like curvy on the bottom of your foot, and it would hurt and it would itch. And so the only way that they could kill the worms, they would have to freeze it. And the other worm that we all got was when my maids would hang clothes out on the line out in their yard, and flies would come and lay eggs. And these would burrow underneath your skin, and you'd have little lumps like where they were. And then I remember my mother would have to take Vaseline, and she would cover the little sores that we would have on us. And then the larva couldn't breathe. And then she would take tweezers and pull the little worms out of our skin. But we also had to take malaria pills. And I hated my malaria pills. Back then, the French did not coat the pills, and they were made with quinine. Very, very, very bitter. And so I would pretend to take them, and then I got malaria. And I loved going with my dad into the jungle, but it was kind of a little odd because I had long hair and, of course, lighter skin color than the tribe people that we would go visit. And I just would see these people in this little jungle area, and they weren't used to ever seeing a white girl. And they would kind of come and paw me. I mean, they were being nice, but they would touch my hair. And my dad would always tell me, remember where you are. Remember who you are. You smile. You don't act afraid. You know, my dad would sometimes have to be invited by the head of the tribes to go into their tents. And I would just go and travel with them and all along in the Ivory Coast. We went and spent a few months in the Canary Islands, and we went by a banana boat because there was no freighter that went to the Canary Islands. So it was just a boat that carried bananas. And so I remember going there, and I loved the Canary Islands. And I was 13, and I would love that they would play with their little castanets, Islas Canarias. They would be singing and dancing. And I was so excited because I got to hear my first song of the Beatles. Because when you're in the Ivory Coast, Libya and Morocco, I mean, you don't have TV. You know, you don't have any access to any kind of entertainment like that. This would have been like 1965, 66, and I Want to Hold Your Hand came out. And I asked my dad if I could have that record, and he said, oh, no, that's just bad songs. Oh, it's not good songs. That's just, you know. So can you imagine, you know, now I Want to Hold Your Hand? I mean, it's, you know, come a long way. So anyway, the next year, my parents thought that I should go to boarding school in Switzerland. I couldn't go to the same boarding school that my sister went to because hers was just older. So I went to the Collège du Léman. It was in Versoix, Switzerland, which is right outside of Geneva. So when I was 13 years old, by myself, off I go to a boarding school in Switzerland. There was half the school was taught in English, half in French. And my roommate was Niloufar Pahlavi. And Pahlavi, she was an Iranian princess. The Pahlavi family is the ousted Shah of Iran at this point now. I got to go by train to Geneva, and I got to see my first movie at age 13, and it was My Fair Lady. And when you traveled by train there, you had to wear a dress and hats and gloves. And I just felt so special. And I could not believe getting to go see a movie. And, you know, it was a big fancy theater with big red velvet drapes and that kind of thing. I learned all the songs to My Fair Lady, and I can still sing them today, but I spent a year there and I just love it. The next main place that I lived was when my dad went to Vietnam. Morrison Knudsen had a big job for the government there. There was no ship going there. It was a wartime and you couldn't have a ship going. So I remember my mother being afraid, but we went by air. So we flew into Tanzanut Air Force Base, and it was the day before the Tet Offensive of 1968. 1968, the Viet Cong came and attacked Saigon. And so we were relatively safe, I guess, but Saigon had been much safer until when we arrived, and then the war came into the city. And that's when they brought up many, many troops, hundreds of thousands of troops from our country the next day into Vietnam. That was a turning point of the war. But I have quite a few memories of Vietnam, but I went to an international school. There was some Americans who just had a teacher that they hired, and so we went there for a year or two. But then I graduated from high school through correspondence. This certainly was before the internet. So when I say correspondence, I mean you write your answers longhand and you lick an envelope and you send it to the States. And it was the University of Nebraska Extension Division. They had a high school through correspondence. You know, you would wait a month and then your grade would come back. I always told people that I graduated first in my class because it was just me. So I like to tell people that I graduated first in my class. And then when they look at me, because they know that I'm not that kind of a person to be like braggy that way. And then I'll say, well, out of one.
As you can imagine, Stephanie had some remarkable, sometimes scary experiences while living in Vietnam.
Living in Saigon was a wonderful experience for me, but I became good friends with my maid and my cook, Mui and Sao. They weren't even actually much older than I was. They would name their children by numbers. So my main maid was Mui, and that's number 10 in Vietnamese, and Sao was number 6. She was only like 2 years older than me, and I didn't have a lot of friends. We had, you know, sometimes 24-hour curfew, sometimes curfew at night, every night. They would roll the barbed wire across your, you know, across the road, and they would have military police out there. I didn't go to church. I just didn't have friends. Most of the places where I lived, very few Americans lived in the places that I lived. And so I became good friends with Mui and Sao. I would love to go down there, and I would help them, you know, wash our laundry on the rocks, and because we didn't have a washing machine, we didn't have hot water. And I loved to cook with them. Chios, the little Vietnamese, like egg rolls, but made with rice paper. Everybody knows that's my favorite food. We lived next door to a military intelligence battalion headquarters. And across the street was a cemetery. So it was during the Tet celebration of the Chinese New Year when the Viet Cong came and attacked Saigon because of all of the fireworks and everything else. So the Viet Cong had dug tunnels up underneath a lot of cemeteries in town. And then they would have fake funerals, and they would put a lot of guns and ammunition inside the casket. And then they would go and bury the ammunition in different places in the different cemeteries. So in May of 1968, the Viet Cong had decided on another attack onto Saigon. And so then they would dig up the caskets that were in the cemetery across the street from where I lived. On one side of us, there was a police station. On the other side was an American military intelligence officer battalion headquarters. And there was a lot of gunfire shooting from the cemetery to the military headquarters next to me and to the police station. So we were kind of, we would always get bullets and things on our roof and that kind of thing. We became good friends with a lot of the military there, that they would come and visit us. There were times that we probably weren't as safe. The main time that was fearful for me was when I was still going to school in the international school. And there was going to be a party at the end of the year, and it was on a Sunday. And our driver normally didn't work on Sunday, but my dad asked him if he would take me to the school for this party. So I was at the party, and then when the party was over, Ree wasn't there. This was long before cell phones, but I mean, our home didn't have a phone. You don't call people. I waited for quite a while, and Ree didn't come. And so I was getting very scared. And this taxi driver pulled up, and I told him my address on Chi Lang Street. And he started to take off, and he didn't go the way that I thought it was to get back to Chi Lang Street. And he kept going faster and faster, and he got out of the city limits, and he was just taking off out into the country. And I don't know to this day what his intent to do with me. We were headed towards Cambodia, and it's only 30-some miles away from Cambodia, but he wasn't going to let me go, and he was going as fast as he could and telling me no. He just kept telling me no, and I was screaming and crying. So at some point, probably like a half hour, there was a roadblock. And it was from our military. And I could see the tanks, the jeeps up there ahead. And he pulled up and ran off. And then our military didn't know what was happening and had guns pulled. And I remembered, it was just so surreal to me to think that the words that my father taught me in French, "I am an American," that I said back when I was in the Ivory Coast, that here I am saying it again in English. "I'm an American. I'm an American." And they were American. And those words, "I am an American," and what that meant to me that day when they took me under their wing and drove me back. They got me safely back to my house. So being an American was very important to me growing up, and it has remained that way. All my kids know how I feel about patriotism, into politics and all that's going on. And I want to make sure my grandchildren know why we vote and all those things. I remember when I got to go to another movie there. Oh, and I got TV. We had a little black and white TV, and they had brought a station in for the military. And believe it or not, the only show that I think that we actually saw, can you believe it? It was Combat. It was a TV show called Combat. Isn't that kind of funny that that's the TV show that they would bring in for the military? But anyway, so we only lived 1 mile away from Tontsenut Air Force Base. And in order to go see a movie, you'd have to have your passport with you, and then you'd get in this little Lambretta. Lambretta is a little three-wheeler, tiny little bus. So you'd get on a little Lambretta, and then he would take you as close as you could get to the entrance of the Air Force Base. And there, they'd have first-run movies, and I got to see a couple of movies there. They would stand at attention and have a hand over their heart and sing the Pledge of Allegiance and Star-Spangled Banner before every movie. But I always thought that was, like, way cool to be able to go to a movie. One time when they thought it was safe enough, I got to go to Vung Tau. It was a beach. And it was on an island, most beautiful beaches. But we had to fly by plane to get there. But it was an old military plane that had canvas seats along the side, like in old World War II movies. So we would get on the little plane, and they would fly us into the island of Vung Tau so that we could go swimming. And so that was kind of cool. The other main thing that happened when I was in Vietnam, when it got safe enough, my mother wanted to go to Bangkok, and so she took me. My mother and I left on a freighter to go to Bangkok. And when we got on the ship, it again has about 12 passengers. My mom said, "Oh, the captain's name is Captain Parrish. I hope
That's not an omen. I don't remember how many days it took us to get to Bangkok, but Bangkok is up 60 miles up a channel from the Gulf of Siam. So when we were getting into the Gulf, the ship had to follow a pilot boat to take you up the channel because you have to know how to maneuver. Well, our captain and my mom and everybody, they had partied the night before, and I guess the captain had gotten a little too drunk. And he, instead of following the flashing light from the pilot boat, he followed the flashing light that was saying danger from an impending sandbar. So our heavy laden freighter hit that sandbar with a vengeance that I thought the whole ship was going to break in half, shuddering and, you know, creaking, and the lights went out, and, you know, and we just slid so slowly across this sandbar, and we were stuck. And we weren't very far from the coastline. I could see the coast. And so they wouldn't let my mom and I get off on the little boats that would come and unload the cargo from our ship. So they would come every day in the morning and take some freight off the ship to see if we could raise up above the sandbar. And it took about a week. It was later in life that one time then I was giving a talk, and it was on repentance. And I remembered that story in my life. And I thought about that when we are burdened down with sins or things that of our regrets in life, we can't travel further in our journey, and we're burdened down. And until we unburden, ask for forgiveness, go through the repentance process, we can't continue. That to me was a real visual of what the penance process was like, of unburdening of the freight from our ship. Because then one day we were afloat, and then we continued on our way up to Bangkok, and we were able to enjoy that time together. And we got to go. There's a famous movie during World War II. It's A Bridge Over the River Kwai. And that's an old famous movie. And there's actually The Bridge Over the River Kwai. And in the movie, it's da-da, da-da-da-da-da. And so my mom and I, we went deep into Thailand. And I remember going and running across that bridge, singing that little song. And Bangkok was just absolutely beautiful, and we were free, and we could stay out late at night because there's no curfew. Because, you know, like I said, when you live in a war zone, that you don't go out at night. When I was in Vietnam during the war, Brent was here, and they had the draft. And for any young person who doesn't know how the draft works, they put 365 dates, one every date of the year. He told me it was like a bingo thing that you'd turn, but, you know, I don't know exactly. I never saw it. And then for the next year, I don't know when this was done every year, but it must have been done at the end of every year for the upcoming year when you turn 18. So my husband's birthday is March 18th. If they pulled out March 18th first, your draft number's one, and you better go sign up the next day. But his number was 320 something or other. And he said that, I didn't know him at the time, but that he said that women and children would have gone to war before him, because it would have had to take every one of our young men away from our country. So he always liked to tell people that, well, somebody had to serve in the war. So, you know, so he always says that, you know, pretends like it was me that served in the war, but I wouldn't ever claim to have served in the war. But I was there during very, very influential years of my life. It was getting close to the time when Americans were leaving. My parents' marriage was on the rocks, and they did get a divorce a few years later. But after Vietnam, they lived in Paris, France. And my girlfriend and I decided that we were going to hitchhike through Europe. And this is back in the 70s when it was kind of safe, you know. So since Paris, France was kind of in the middle of Europe, and so my friend Debbie and I, we would hitchhike for a few days, and then we would want a nice shower and a bed and good meal. So we'd come back to Paris and be with my parents for a little while. Then we would go and hitchhike around Europe again. So we traveled for 2 or 3 months all around Europe. And that was really quite exciting. And when I look back on it, I just kind of like want to cover my eyes thinking, I can't believe I did that. But my dad always wanted us to do exciting things. He was the one that said that he wanted us to discover dinosaur eggs or a black rose, or if we could come up with an item that at the time would be 50 cents that every household in America would need. I mean, he just thought it was just the best thing ever. So fun to go out there and hitchhike. My mother was always a little bit more worried about us and scared, but you know, she was a mom, but that was my dad. I don't think I knew at the time that they really were maybe separating, but they probably were. But my mom and I and my younger sister and younger brother and another female friend of my mom's and her children all moved into this big, huge home, a villa in Puerto Rico. And so we lived there for a while. I loved that house. It was really cool. And it had big avocado trees. And avocados, when they would fall, poof, poof, you could just hear them falling on your roof. And our dishwasher didn't work at the time. And there were so many avocados that we would just fill our dishwasher with avocados. I just remember thinking the whole dishwasher was full of avocados. But I got to drive for the first time. And so I had a little VW bug. And I would drive my brother and sister around the island. And we would go down to the beach. And it was just, oh, just beautiful. It was just another fun, free place where you could just get away from, you know, the places that I had lived, you know, like Tripoli. And even in the Ivory Coast, you just don't send kids off to go play and there's no one else to go play with. But when I was in Vietnam, I had a family friend, the Peerts, and they had two daughters. And they were from Boise, Idaho. When Morrison Knudsen had that big job in Vietnam, they needed just extra people for that one job. So they hired the Peert family, Stephen, Bonnie Peart, and then their two daughters, and they happened to be my age, and they didn't live very far away from us, so I actually had a friend, and that was really fun. And so I remember hearing about Boise. Now, my dad and my mom grew up in two little towns in eastern Washington, Mapton and Prosser, and they loved the West. So I was getting to the age where he just really thought, you know, you better kind of, you know, like, settle down somewhere, you know. And my mom too, she had never lived in the States now all these years. In fact, my father could never vote because they never owned a home. They never had an address in the States. But my mother was trying to figure out what she was going to do with her life. And my dad told me he thought that I should move to Boise and find myself a cowboy and move out west. My friend that I had met in Vietnam, who had returned to Boise, she was getting married, and I was in Puerto Rico, and she asked if I would come and be her maid of honor. I flew into Boise for that and loved Boise and decided this is where I was going to make my home. So I flew back to Puerto Rico and packed my stuff and moved to Boise, Idaho. My mom decided that she would do the same, and shortly after, she and my younger sister and younger brother moved here as well. My older sister by then was married, and then she eventually moved out here.
And that's how, after living all over the world, Stephanie ended up in Boise, Idaho, and met the man who would become her husband.
I got a little apartment, and I got a job. It's called the International Dunes Motel. I work behind the desk between 3 o'clock shift to 11 p.m. And the person who would come on to take over my shift was my now husband, Brent. And he was a night auditor, and he came on at 11 p.m. And I instantly liked him. I just thought he was really cool. And my younger sister had met the missionaries of the church when she lived in Paris, France. She actually had been wanting to go to church a lot, and none of the rest of us did. So she used to kind of go by herself in different countries that we lived, and she was much younger than the rest of us. But when the LDS missionaries knocked on our apartment door in Paris, my mom invited them in. My dad was gone on a business trip. I was gone hitchhiking around Europe. And so my younger sister finally, after being baptized twice, once in an international Protestant church, one as a Methodist, she finally found in her mind that she just
felt that this was true. And but when my dad came home from the business trip, he said, hey, you know, you've been baptized twice. I grew up with Mormons. They're a cult. And you're not going to go to church with them, and they're not allowed back in the house. So I did not meet the missionaries that one time. When we finally moved here, my sister was still wanting to join the church. My mother would get up every single morning and take her to seminary. And I remember hearing from my sister about the church a little bit, and she really wanted to join the church. And I said, well, Mom says you can. And I will always remember what my younger sister said. She said, you have to learn to obey your earthly father before you can obey your heavenly father. And I thought, well, okay. Well, one day my dad sent a letter to Debbie giving her permission to join the church. And I remember her reading that letter and falling on the floor crying. And I still didn't get it. Well, I went to work, and Brent came on afterwards and said, my sister's going to join the church. He said, I'm Mormon. I was thinking, like, you are? You know, I had known him for a long time, and he had never said anything. I, you know, just started talking to him. And he worked the 11 p.m. shift, the 7 a.m. shift, and you know, working behind the desk at that small hotel, there was not a lot of people checking in and checking out. So it was just, you know, he and I, and we talked, and he could just pay attention because he couldn't leave because he was on shift. And I just stayed after my shift. So we just stayed and talked. And I liked him a lot. And we became just good friends. I wanted it to be more, but he didn't seem. And, you know, he started saying that, you know, the only way he would get married to someone was in the temple and a member of the church. And I was thinking, like, hey, I'll join the church. You know, if that's, I know that people say that's not the best way to join the church. You should join it for yourself and not for someone else, but it worked for me. That's all I can say. I didn't have any religion in my life, and I thought, why not? You know, I mean, that sounds good. And I loved the idea of eternal families, and that was the only thing I really knew. And so Brent had the missionaries come and talk to me, and, you know, I was joining the church for Brent. But I did think at the time, it might be a good idea to have some religion in my life. So anyway, we didn't really date. We would just like hang out together. So maybe we were more than just friends. I mean, I considered him more than a friend, but I didn't know how he honestly felt. I never particularly thought that maybe he had those feelings for me, but I was okay just like being with him, but I was so much in love with him. But I was contemplating. I didn't talk to him about it. It was something I thought, you know, I think I just need to move on. And travel was easy for me, and I knew I could make it somewhere else. So my sister and his sister both went down to BYU. They were the same age. And Brent said, oh, they're both going to be married by the end of the year. And I'm thinking, like, oh, my sister, she's like 6 years younger than me. But she did. She got married by the end of that next year, and so did Julie. Brent's parents lived in Seattle, and Julie was having a reception also in Seattle. Brent was going to drive there to go to the reception, and he asked me if I wanted to go with him. I was going to get to meet his family, and I thought, wow, this is pretty exciting. We arrived the day before Julie's reception. The night before her reception was the ice capades. Brent had asked his parents to please get an extra ticket for me, and they were good tickets. I think they were on the front row. And so there was Brent and Brent's parents and his brother, Julie and her new husband, and we're all sitting there before the show, and Brent pulls this little box out of his pocket and opens it up, and he says, well, do you want to make it official? And I knew it had to be a joke. He had told me that when he was at the Y, that he had played a joke on with this girl that he was dating, and like a Cracker Jack ring that she thought was real. And I remember him laughing about it once, and I thought that was cruel. And there was no way that could be a real ring. And I was so embarrassed, and I was so upset. And I closed that box, and I said, in a teary voice, don't you ever do that to me again. And I was so embarrassed in front of his whole family that he would do this. Well, Brent's mother on one side of me and Brent's sister on the other side of him, they're going, what was that? What was that? And I went, oh, nothing, nothing. And then I realized that Julie didn't have her ring on her finger. And I thought, oh, he's playing a joke with her ring. Well, she had only been married for a week, and she was getting her ring soldered together, and she was going to pick him up at the jeweler the next day for the reception. So that's why she didn't have a ring on. But I thought, oh, they're all in on this sick joke. And so she took the box, and she says, this isn't my ring. And then Brent's mom grabbed the box. And Brent's just sitting there shocked because he didn't know what to do, because he thought that's what I would want. And that's why he felt comfortable asking in front of his family. And it took me a little while to believe it and to think that they all weren't in on it, because I didn't even know this family. And they're all passing my ring box around. And so when I finally thought, oh my goodness, it's real. And he just asked me to marry him. And I'd known him for, you know, 2-3 years. And I just couldn't believe it. It was just a shock to me. And it was too small for me. And so I couldn't put the ring on. But I was staying at his parents' house. And, you know, they had a separate, you know, room for me. And I remember that night holding that box on my chest. And all night long, I kept waking up and opening up the box to see if it was real and closing the box. And I just couldn't even believe that I was going to get married. And I knew that, you know, it was going to be in the temple. I was perfectly fine with that. But I realized as it got closer to that time that I was giving up my dream, which was having my father give me away, walking me down the aisle and having my mother there for his dream, which was to be sealed in the temple, which was, you know, his dream growing up. Wasn't my dream. And so, you know, that was difficult. My father still lived overseas. But my mother went down to Salt Lake and cried and sat outside the temple when we were in there getting married. And, you know, that wasn't particularly the happiest day of my life, you know, to say goodbye to your mother as she's crying and sitting outside the temple, and you go in and get married. And that experience was all new to me. And I was happy I was married, but the process wasn't a joyous event. So that was, you know, a little hard for me. I'd never got to know my grandparents, any of my aunts or uncles or cousins, because you don't take them with you when you're traveling overseas. So I didn't know any of them. But I got to know Brent's family and Brent's grandparents. I loved Brent's grandparents. When we told Brent's grandparents we were going to get married, it was in May. He said, well, Brent, I think you should get married on September 20th, the day that your grandparents and great-grandparents got married. And it would be an honor if you would get married on September 20th. And well, this was May 13th. And Brent, that was like a little too soon. And then Brent's grandpa said, Brent, I knew your grandmother for 2 years before we got married. And I wish I had asked her to marry me 2 years earlier so we could have had that much more time to be together. And that's the greatest regret of my life, that I didn't ask her sooner. Don't have the same regret. So we got married on September 20th. And I remember looking at the calendar and I said, well, Grandpa, that's on a Tuesday. And he said, in the next year, it'll be a Wednesday and then a Thursday and then a Friday. And Tuesday, September 20th, 1977, we went down to Salt Lake. The Boise Temple wasn't here yet. So on that Monday night, we stayed at the Howard Johnson Hotel, and we'd all gone out to dinner, my mother and Brent's parents and my sister Debbie that had gotten married earlier that year. And so we all went out to dinner. When we came back to the hotel, there had been a fire in the hotel, and they had pleased and taped off. And the whole thing wasn't burning down to the ground, but there was a fire in the hotel. But it wasn't in the section of the hotel where our room was, two rooms, and he went through the tape. The police and the firemen didn't see him sneaking into the hotel, and he came running out with our temple recommends, our rings, and my wedding dress. So, you know, he made up for all the years that it took him to ask me to marry him. Except for 1 year of my church life, I have lived in this home in Boise. So what a huge difference of growing up in so many different places, because my four children went to schools on McMillan Road. Two of my kids went to McMillan Elementary. Two of them went to Pioneer. All four went to Lowell Scott. All four went to St. Tenniel High School, and they're all on McMillan Road. And my schools were, you know, private French schools, schools on Air Force bases, boarding schools in Switzerland, taking correspondence, all kinds of different schools. And there was something very sweet to me that, I mean, I've always wanted to go home, and I haven't been able to go home. I mean, you know, I'm hoping to maybe go to Vietnam. I would never be able to go find my house. I don't even know where they are, you know. But to be able to live here in Boise, and there's something amazing when we see all the three little houses that Brent lived in. When we were addressing all the envelopes for the reception, we were sending envelopes to friends around the world. Of my parents' friends, they lived all around the world. And all of Brent's friends were 83703 zip code of the north end of Boise, Idaho, in the 3300 block of whatever street, you know. And my mom got a big kick out of that, you know. To be able to go back and see the homes where he lived, you can go back home. There's something about going back to see where you grew up that brings, I think it brings back whole circle or something. There's something amiss in my life that I haven't been able to go do that. But also all my four kids grew up here, and this is the home that they knew.
The joy of Stephanie's life has been raising her four children with Brent.
Kimberly was born in 1980, and Mandy was born in 1982. That Grandpa Rich, the grandpa that I love so much, that got us to get married on September 20th. And when I was pregnant with Mandy, and she was due on 17th, and he said, "Stephanie, I think you should have your baby on September 20th. And I said, "Grandpa, not on my anniversary." And she was born on September 20th. So we've had many generations of that special day of September 20th. And when I was pregnant with Mandy, Brent and I went to Europe together. I got to go and show him my school in Switzerland. And Brent's brother, he was serving a mission in Switzerland. So we got to see him while he was on his mission. And then we went on the hydrofoil across France over. And my dad had retired there on the cliffs of Dover. And then rented a car, went down to Rome and all around there. That was a wonderful trip that he and I had. And then I tried to have more children, and I had three miscarriages and just wasn't sure that I was ever going to be able to have another child at that point. In fact, my doctor just said, you know, you have two kids and, you know, you're getting older and, you know, you're probably going to need to be happy with that. And then I got pregnant and I had twins. And Brent's brother had twins and Brent's sister had twins. So Brent's sister had identical twin boys and Brent's brother had fraternal girls. And then I had one of each. So that was really special. So when Mandy was 8 and Kimberly was 10, I had my twins. And it's interesting that how your childhood dreams can evolve and change, because soon after joining the church, well, it took me maybe a little while, I don't know at what point, I realized that my dreams for my children was that they would get married in the temple. You know, so different. You know, just to see how your mind can evolve and change. And so that's been a joy.
And as is true with most young families, there was a lot going on at the Nye household.
I had a daycare in my home. I was always able to be here for them when they came home from school. I was always here for them. And, you know, like when you come home from school, that's when you needed to help mom. It was never relax, you know, put down your book bag and watch some TV. It's like, go get these kids up from nap and help me with this snack. And I'm sure it wasn't fun for them, you know, to always have someone sleeping in their room. But I've had kids who've grown up who've come and knocked on my door, and I open up the door and I don't even recognize this teenage boy, and he'll say, "I'm Timmy Friel. I wanted to come and show you my driver's license. I can drive." Or kids coming back and saying, "I'm a dad now and I wanted to show my little kid where I grew up." And then I've been invited to weddings and baby showers. And so I was the constant for them, you know, It was an eye-opener for me because there are a lot of single moms who had to work. And so I remember how sad it was on Fridays that parents would use the daycare for the trading place. It was just really sad to me. But I was always grateful that I could always be here for my kids when they came home from school.
The Nye family was involved in lots of activities and shared many, many adventures together.
We took them camping. My Kimberly, my oldest, did something for the youth, Congressional Medal. And then my daughter Mandy did it as well. And during those, there was different things you had to do to qualify for those. But one of the things that you had to do was you had to have all outdoor activities. So we would camp a lot. We'd go to Silver Spring Plunge, or we would go camping to fulfill those requirements. Or my son with his Eagle Scout to camp with that. Brent loved to fish. Me, not so much. He always would say, you know, a bad day fishing is better than a good day at work. Later on in life, when after we retired, I had the most fun time with Brent because we bought a camper. And we would go up to McCall, and that was kind of like our happy place. I loved it up there. We spent a lot of time there. My sister and her husband, Kathy, they never had any children. They were both teachers, so they would come here a lot. They would take my daughter, Kimberly, like to Sweden and, you know, places like that. Then they paid for Kimberly and Mandy to go to France on a trip together there. And then they would take my girls, my two older girls, on road trips in the summer, sometimes 10,000 mile, 26 state trips. So they go down to Florida, up to Niagara Falls, and all the way in between. And so my two older kids got to do some really pretty fun summer things I could never leave with my daycare. And then my younger kids were, you know, hadn't been born yet or much younger. And Brent's parents served a mission in Texas. And we were going to take the kids to Florida, to Disney World with my sister and her husband. And Brent was called to be high priest group leader. And he was going to be ordained a high priest. So we flew into Texas so that Brent's father could ordain him as a high priest. And then we went on as a family to Florida, to Disney World. And, you know, that was a special time there. We were always active in the church. Brent was a young men's president, things like that. So we took him camping there. I was known as someone who cooked. And so I was always asked to cook for every reception, hundreds of receptions at ward campouts, the youth camps, the stake youth camps. Brent and I, they would have us always do the cooking, you know. So that was a big thing. One thing, though, that we did do that was when Becky and BJ probably were juniors in high school, my stake went to Martin's Cove. They went on a trek. But I was asked to be on the food committee. Well, Brent's mother was the oldest, and then she had two sisters, and then she had a younger brother who wasn't very much older than Brent because, you know, she was a teenager and Val and Brent were only 2 or 3 years apart or whatever. So he, Val, and his wife were on a mission at Martin's Cove. So Brent and I drove there the night before the trek was going to start. And I told them that, you know, I didn't have plans on walking. And they said, Stephanie, you have to walk. You're here at Martin's Cove. So if you get tired or can't walk, we'll come pick you up in the golf cart. So I said, okay. And I walked, and it was so empowering. That was one of my testimony of the pioneers, actually, was because Brent's pioneer family had come on the Martin Effnan handcart company. So when we were there, it was just very special. And so my two kids and Brent and I each had a lanyard with one of the, it was a whole family, three generations of Brent's family that had been there. So that was a very powerful moment for me to be able to do that. That was awesome. Our whole family went on a cruise up to Alaska. We went a couple of Christmases ago. I said to Brent, I want to take the whole family on a cruise because we knew it would be his last Christmas. So all of my children and their spouses and all of my grandchildren went down to Mexico together, and we were at Cabo San Lucas on Christmas, and that was really special. Brent was in a wheelchair, but we did it, and we had a special time. And then this past summer, we all went again on a cruise over into Hawaii.
Clearly, Stephanie is an incredible wife, mother, and grandmother. She shared a few memories and things she admires about each of her four kids.
Our wonderful kids, they all were good kids to have growing up. So Kimberly played the flute, and she was in band, and she was, you know, valedictorian, and she went and got those congressional awards, and just, you know, always an achiever that way. Mandy is, you know, footloose and fancy free, you know, kind of always. She knew her husband when they were in school together, and we were so busy because she was in club soccer and high school soccer. And then BJ loved football and loved scouting, and at a very young age she became an Eagle Scout and loves to this day fishing and camping and all of that. And Becky was also into sports and loved soccer and did as much traveling around as Kimberly did. They all had good friends, and they've all stayed close to their friends. And, you know, for my son to tell me that he loves me on the phone just is very tender to me, and I can tell that he wants to watch over me and taking on that role. I'm very blessed to have all of them. They're all, four of them are such good parents, and I'm just so grateful for that. I'm very grateful to have them nearby.
Stephanie's children are certainly a credit to her, and also her dear husband, Brent. She shared a bit about him and some wonderful memories they shared.
He comes from an apostle in the church, Charles C. Rich. His family came over in the Willie Martin Handcart Company, and they have a tabernacle in Paris, Idaho, that was built partly by Brent's great-grandfather. There's a statue in St. Charles. Charles C. Rich is his great-great-grandfather, and it's the Charles C. Rich Monument. I mean, so his church lines go deep and long. Brent's mother got married as a teenager and had Brent 9 months and 1 week later. Brent was 11 years old at his mother's 10-year high school class reunion. And he remembered the fun games that they played, and they had the potato sack race. And most kids, you can imagine, if anyone had children at their 10-year high school class reunion, they're what, 2 and 3 and 4? So Brent loved to tell me the stories of how he won all the games. He said he was kind of embarrassed thinking back. He didn't realize he wasn't supposed to win all the games. But on the potato sack race, well, this little two-year-old was so little that Brent was with. He was 11. So he just picked up the little kid and carried him across the, you know. So he had fun stories like that. And he knew all of his cousins, aunts, uncles, and his grandparents moved from Eastern Idaho to Meridian. He was the oldest of four, and he had 3 boys and 1 girl. He used to always say that his parents would say that Julie was the rose among the thorns. He went to Capital High School and BSU and BYU, and, you know, he's 6 months younger than me, and he likes to tease me. When I would turn 30, he'd still be 29. So he would always give me really cool antiques, because he said an antique for an antique. Our parents were, mothers were pregnant at the same time, but, you know, he liked to always tease me, and he would say, oh, someone came into work today. She was about your age, you know. Brent was the most patient, just very patient. I think, you know, that's what it was, no rush to marry me or that kind of thing. And he loved to hunt and fish, and he was definitely the patient one, the patient parent of the two. He always said, see you when the sun shines. Every day he would call me from work, and he would say, what do you need for lunch? You know, because I could never leave the house because of the daycare. And he would always run and do the errands. He'd call me every single day. And I said, well, what are your plans tonight? And he'd say, just to make my wife happy. But he was just so kind. Brent loved 55 Chevys. Well, he loved cars, but he loved 55 Chevys. And when we first got married, for the first year, we lived in Nampa. He found this old
shell of a car, a 55 Chevy, didn't have an engine, but it was out in some farmer's yard and paid $500 for it, I think. But we had to push it. It didn't have a motor, so we pushed it into our garage. And when we moved here, we had to push it into this garage. When time and money would permit, he would rebuild and build the engine and redo the insides. It was his dream car. He loved that car. For 40 years, it sat in our garage, and it didn't run. I mean, it had the engine. It was getting close. I mean, actually, really pretty close, but it didn't run. When Brent got sick, we didn't realize what was wrong with him at first. He'd had two neck surgeries over the course of years, and so his neck was bothering him again, and the doctor thought that he was going to have another neck surgery. But so it took a long time for us to realize what was happening to him. But during that time, when we finally realized that he had ALS and there is no cure for that, Brent's younger brother, Mike, who lives in Kimberly, Idaho, came to Boise every weekend to work on Brent's car. And he would come after work on Friday, and Brent and I would already be up in bed, up in our bed, and Mike would work out there till late, late, late at night. BJ would come over here and work a lot beside Mike. It was Mike's dream to get his older brother's car working for him before he passed away. So it was the last month of Brent's life that we had a 55 Chevy celebration. Brent wasn't able to drive. He couldn't lift his arms. He had to have someone pull his arms up to put his arms on the steering wheel. And Mike drove the car and my son, BJ. So we got to have the 55 Chevy working. And then when Brent passed away, my son, BJ, said, "Mom, I want to come pick you up." Brent's funeral was just in a church just a couple blocks away, but BJ wanted to drive me to the church in the 55 and then to Dry Creek Cemetery in the 55. So that was nice. My parents, like I said, got a divorce, and my mother died suddenly, you know, in her early 60s, and she was in Seattle, and she had to be life-flighted from where she lived in Olympia, Washington, which is the capital. She had to be life-flighted to Seattle. She had to have her leg amputated, and then she never really gained consciousness for 11 days and died. But when I talked to my dad, I wanted my dad, even as an adult, and I guess somehow that preconceived idea again, when I was talking to him on the phone, I wanted him with us, and he wasn't there for us. His life hadn't changed that day. He was still a divorcee and not a widower. It's interesting how, even as an adult, I can get emotional about that because I felt like he left us again. And I remember thinking, it was long before my twins were born, so they never got to meet my parents, but I remember thinking and praying that the biggest gift I could give to my children is that my marriage would last, and that when one of us passed away, we would still be married. And I've told my kids, I think I did last year when Brent passed away, that I was so sad that their father had died. And it was like a gift, in a sense, that I was giving them, because I was doing what my father didn't do for me, and I was grieving next to my children. And I was so grateful for that moment when I could say, "Brent, we did it. We were married to the end of this life, and of course, we'll be together again." I feel like I've had three lives. My life of growing up overseas with my family, my life being married as a member of the church, and now as a widow. And this is a whole different experience. My kids are now married and have kids of their own. And I try not to ask my kids for help often. It's been over a year since Brent passed away. And it means it's a year closer to when I get to see him. And I believe that. I don't know where I learned things. I didn't go to church. And that never seemed unusual to me that I was going to live with my family again. I mean, it wasn't a shock to me to hear that. That was not something that when the missionaries taught me that I thought was new. I thought, well, of course. So that part was something in me. I think I knew that already. You know, I think before you are baptized, you know, that the Holy Ghost can be like a strobe light, and you don't have it with you at all times like you do after you're baptized. But I had times in my life, like when that taxi, I didn't know I was really praying, but I was praying, you know. I didn't know what I was doing. But I mean, I had different times that I knew that I was going to be okay or something. And I, looking back, I know that that was the Holy Ghost. My testimony came slowly. I gained a testimony of certain things as time went on. And it wasn't until I started having children that I really realized how much I knew that the Savior lived and died for me, and that I had an eternal family, and that these children were a gift from God, and that I only had them for a short time, and that they would return to their Heavenly Father. And I hope that all of my children and my grandchildren know that I know that my Savior lives, and that I know that we will all live together again, and that I am grateful to be a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I am so grateful for all of my children and how they love their spouses and are good parents. And I hope that you will stay close to the Lord and remember that we will all live together again and that we will be with your Father. And I appreciate what you've done for me. And I hope that you will always live the life that you are now. And I appreciate all of you and I love all of you.
As you've heard, Stephanie is a beautiful, radiant force for good. She had an extraordinary childhood traveling the world and has dedicated her adult life to serving those around her, following the Lord, and loving her family. A huge thank you to Kimberly Hudson for signing up for the giveaway, and congrats on winning. And thank you to Stephanie Nye for being interviewed. If there's someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email us at hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website, hearingourheritage.com.